Good afternoon or good evening, depending on when you will be listening to this. My name is Peter Kuchinka, and today I will be reading from the Bloomington Normal Pantograph, the e-edition from Monday, May 4th, 2026. I'll start with the front page. The front page has a story about the farmers market springs back. There's a nice photo of a woman in front of plants, and it reads, "Fresh basil plants were available Saturday from Kathy Troyer of Troyer Family Gardens at opening day of the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market. Opening day, a big draw for downtown seasonal event," by Jack Alkire. Another photo, a line of customers waits for fresh strawberries at Flem Orchard on Saturday. Saturday kicked off the first day of the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market, and for some it held the same excitement as the first day of school. "Somebody said this earlier, that it's like going back to grade school or something," said Drake Parker, owner of Middle Fork Farms, with his wife Charlie. "Like, you got your class assignments and you get to see all your friends. It's just, it feels great, feels good to be back out in the sun." "It even started on the drive in from Danvers," she said. "The sun was coming up, sky looked beautiful, just put a smile on your face," Parker said. "The market averages about 2,500 customers in peak season," said Hannah Horn, co-director of the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market, "and Saturday certainly eclipsed that number. It's been an overwhelmingly great response considering the brisk weather that we were dealing with," she said. "The seasonal market exemplifies the idea of a third place or someplace for people to gather that is not work or home, Horn said. "We, as America, are lacking a lot third places where community can come and feel welcome. I feel like the farmers market is a great third space to connect with people at a very low barrier to entry," she said. Besides Hink's Smokehouse food truck, which had a near constant queue, another big draw sat near the corner of Jefferson and Madison Streets, where Flem Orchard from Cobden had brought 4 pallets or 1,600 quarts of strawberries. At one point, the line stretched along the whole block, which made fifth-generation owner Jeff Flem a little uneasy. "Somebody said this early that it's like going back to grade school or something. Like you got your class assignment and you get to see your friends. It feels great. Feels good to be back out in the sun." Drake Parker, owner of Middle Fork Farms, with his wife Carly. "I don't want people to have to stand in line and wait, but they seem okay with it. They're not upset when they get here," she said. By 11 a.m., market goers had nearly depleted 3 of the 4 pallets. Still, the less than warm weather early Saturday morning had some longing to stay in. "It was a little cold, and I'm thinking, oh, I wish I could, kind of. I was back in bed right now," Vicky Hillscotter said with a laugh. "But, you know, it's all worth it." The pork producer has been selling at the farmer's market for 16 of its 29 years, she said. "You get here, and it's absolutely wonderful, because all your friends, everybody who loves your product, they come back to see us. So, you know, it's just a joy," Hillscotter said. "The chill also failed to stop the plant sales," said Kathy Troyer of Troyer Family Gardens. "The plants have been outside all week, so they were all ready for it," she said. "And yeah, it's always exciting to start a new season and see all of your old friends and make some new ones." 2 new friends appeared at the little farm at Weldon Springs as owners Anna Morrill and Christopher Dunn Rankin brought their newborn twins with them. "Last year, everyone was so supportive and excited to see them. So yeah, it's great to be back and see everyone's faces and be able to show them what we made," Morrill said, laughing. "Hopefully everyone is understanding that we're taking a little bit easier this year. We're only raising 1 batch of chicken and 1 batch turkey because obviously our focus is a little extra split right now because of the plural babies." The next story is also related to food, and it reads, officials revamp funding formula, board eyes shift in counting of low-income students, expects low Fed law to shrink SNAP rolls. It's the by Peter Hancock, Capital News, Illinois, in education. Springfield. The Illinois State Board of Education is asking lawmakers this year for $200,000 to develop a new way of counting low-income students. Although that's only a small fraction of the overall $10.9 billion general revenue fund budget the agency is seeking to fund pre-K-12 public schools next year, their request points to a larger issue that public schools could be facing over the next several years, as the number of students officially counted as low income is expected to drop. That's because Illinois currently counts low-income students based on their enrollment in federal support programs, including Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, temporary assistance for needy families, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. However, under new eligibility rules that were part of the federal budget law Congress passed last year, known as H.R. 1 or the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the number of people enrolled in those programs is expected to decline. Those include changes to SNAP eligibility that went into effect May 1, disqualifying many groups of non-citizens and imposing new work requirements on many able-bodied adults. Although the rules mainly affect adults and therefore aren't expected to have an immediate impact on students, officials have said they believe these rules could eventually cause entire households to become unenrolled in federal aid programs, resulting in fewer children being enrolled as well in future years. We believe we have time to come up with an alternative method, Robin Steens, executive director of the Education Research and Advocacy Group, Advance Illinois, said in an interview. The changes in federal eligibility rules for Medicaid, SNAP, and other federal programs could have a direct impact on the amount of state funding many districts receive through the evidence-based funding formula. That's the formula that lawmakers adopted in 2017 that calls for $300 million in additional funding for public schools each year, with the bulk of that money earmarked for the least adequately funded districts. The formula uses several factors to determine an adequacy target for each district, including the number of teachers and paraprofessionals a district needs based on its enrollment and demographic factors. For example, for kindergarten through third grade classes, the statute says each district should receive funding for one full-time equivalent teacher for 15 low-income students and one for every 20 non-low-income students. For grades 4 through 12, the formula calls for one teacher for every 20 low-income students and one for every 25 non-low-income students. According to data from the state's 2025 report card, there were just over 1.8 million students enrolled in Illinois public schools during the 2024-25 school year. Of those, 49.7%, or 933,470, were classified as low income. The highest concentration of low-income students for any single district was in Carbon Cliff Barstow School District 36 in the Quad City region, which reported 100% of its students qualified as low-income. Lake Forest School District 67 in Lake County reported only 1.3% of its students were low-income. Although many observers say they do not expect the changes in the eligibility rules to have an immediate impact on districts' official poverty rates, they do note that overall enrollments in Medicaid and SNAP has been declining in recent years, for reasons they say they cannot yet explain. According to data from the Illinois Department of Human Services, fewer than 1.7 million people in the state were receiving SNAP benefits in March 2026. That's down 13.7% from a year earlier and 17.8% from March 2023. Likewise, according to the Department of Health Care and Family Services, Medicaid enrollment in Illinois in fiscal year 2025 at 3.26 million was down 5.7% compared to the year before and 18% lower than in the fiscal year 2023. It's the right time for the state to explore other methodologies, Steen said, noting the declining enrollment rates don't comport with our lived experience. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service covering state government that is distributed to more than 400 newspapers statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. The next story relates to national and international news about the Mideast war. Trump: U.S. will escort ships stranded in strait, by Parisa Hafesi and Jacob Bogage from Reuters. And there's a photo of a town. The caption reads, "Smoke rises following an explosion in Lebanon," as seen from the Israeli side of the border with Lebanon on Sunday. Washington: President Donald Trump said Sunday the United States would begin an effort Monday morning to free up ships stranded in the Strait of Hormuz. Trump, in a social media post, gave few details about the operation, including whether the U.S. Navy would be involved. He described the effort as a humanitarian gesture meant only to aid neutral countries that were not involved in the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. "For the good of Iran, the Middle East, and the United States, we have told these countries that we will guide their ships safely out of the restricted waterways so that they can freely and ably get on with their business," Trump wrote in the post. The White House and Pentagon did not immediately respond to requests for additional information. Also on Sunday, Iran said it received a U.S. response to its latest offer for a peace talk, a day after Trump said he would probably reject the Iranian proposal because they have not paid a big enough price. Iranian state media reported that Washington conveyed its response to Iran's 14-point proposal via Pakistan and that Tehran was reviewing it. There was no immediate confirmation from Washington or Islamabad of the U.S. response. "At this stage, we do not have nuclear negotiations," state media quoted Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Ismail Bagheni as saying, an apparent reference to Iran's proposal to set aside talks on nuclear issues until after the war ends and the foes agreed to lift opposing blockades of the Gulf shipping route. On Saturday, Trump said they had yet to review the exact wording of the Iranian peace proposal, but that he was likely to reject it. "I will soon be reviewing the plan that Iran has just sent to us, but I can't imagine that it would be acceptable in that they have not yet paid a big enough price for what they have done to humanity and the world over the last 47 years," he wrote on social media. The United States and Israel suspended their bombing campaign against Iran 4 weeks ago, and U.S. and Iranian officials held one round of talks. But attempts to set up further meetings have so far failed. Iran handed over its latest proposal Thursday, and a senior Iranian official confirmed Saturday that Tehran envisions ending the war and resolving the shipping standoff first, while leaving talks on Iran's nuclear program for later. Though Trump initially said Friday that he was not satisfied with the Iranian proposal, he said Saturday he was still looking at it. "They told me about the concept of a deal. They're going to give me the exact wording now," he told reporters. Asked if he might restart strikes on Iran, Trump replied, "I don't want to say that. I mean, I can't tell that to a reporter. If they misbehave, if they do something bad right now, we'll see. But it's a possibility that could happen." The proposal to delay talks on nuclear issues until a later phase would appear at odds with Washington's repeated demand that Iran accept stringent restrictions on its nuclear program before the war can end. Washington wants Tehran to give up its stockpile of more than 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium, which the United States says could be used to make a bomb. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful, though it is willing to discuss some curbs in return for the lifting of sanctions, as it had accepted in the 2015 deal that Trump abandoned. While saying repeatedly he's in no hurry, Trump is under domestic pressure to break Iran's hold on the Strait of Hormuz, which has choked off 20% of the world's oil and gas supplies and pushed up U.S. gas prices. Trump's Republican Party faces the risk of a voter backlash over higher prices in midterm congressional elections in November. Iranian media said Tehran's 14-point proposal includes withdrawing U.S. forces from nearby areas, lifting the blockade, releasing frozen assets, paying compensation, lifting sanctions, ending the war on all fronts, including Lebanon, and creating a new control mechanism for the Strait. Iran has been blocking nearly all shipping from the Gulf, apart from its own, for more than 2 months. Last month, the U.S. imposed its own blockade on ships from Iranian ports. Speaking on conditions of anonymity to discuss confidential diplomacy, the senior Iranian official said Tehran believed its latest proposal to shelve nuclear talks for a later stage was a significant shift aimed at facilitating the agreement. Under this framework, negotiations over the more complicated nuclear issue have been moved to the final stage to create a more conducive atmosphere, the official said. I'll continue with several items of interest in an article on page 2 of the Monday, May 4th Pentagraph. Today's Flick Fact. Question. I'll continue on the paper's page 2 with the title Today's Flick Fact. Question. State Farm Insurance has a lot of doors locked around the Twin Cities, and so does Rivian Automotive with its thousands of electric trucks out in its lots. But Illinois State University would surely have to lead the Twin Cities with a number of locks. Can you guess how many are at ISU? Answer. The locks alone at last count, there are at least 82,000 of them on the Illinois State campus, according to campus statistics. Pity the poor person in charge of keeping track of them all. The next column is titled How Time Flies. 100 years ago, May 4th, 1926, a year's supply of water, even if no rain fell, would be held in the Mackinac Lake that has been proposed for Bloomington and Normal, according to E.N. Heifer, promoter. The 379 square miles of watershed above the proposed dam is expected to give the lake enough water so that 5 million gallons a day can be drawn. 75 years ago. Now that spring has come, many citizens are feeling the need of a good rest. If any have contemplated taking that rest in a local hospital, his or her plans will have to be altered. A check of the 3 Bloomington Normal hospitals today showed that no beds are available. 50 years ago, May 4, 1976, search warrants will soon be requested by the town of Normal against owners or residents of 15 homes in Northgate and Brightview subdivisions. The 15 residents have either refused or failed to respond to requests for voluntary compliance with the city's sewer inspection. 25 years ago, May 4, 2001, a proposed arena project enters a new stage as the city administration moves from rough estimates to hard facts. In doing so, it all but rules out any site for the arena other than a city-owned downtown area west of the McLean County Law and Justice Center. In the coming weeks, the city will invite companies to submit proposals to design a multi-use arena and give price estimates for it. A rough estimate is now $26 million for a facility that would bring concerts, conventions, minor league professional sports, and public ice skating to the city. Mayor Judy Markovits said on March 3 that she cannot ask the city council to back the project without better financial figures. An article on in the area of government politics. What do Americans think of Trump's attempted Washington, D.C. makeover? By Mike Stunson, USA Today. As President Donald Trump is attempting to make over several parts of Washington, D.C., polling suggests many Americans are uneasy with the scale of his proposed overhaul. Here's a Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll found about how Americans view some of Trump's major proposals in D.C. More than 2,500 Americans were polled April 24th to 28 about their view on a range of topics, including the Trump administration tearing down the East Wing of the White House to build a 90,000-square-foot ballroom. The poll found 56% of people do not support the project, which Trump again framed as necessary after last weekend's shooting at the Washington Hilton during the White House Correspondents' Dinner. This event would never have happened with a militarily top-secret ballroom currently under construction at the White House, Trump said in an April 26 post on Truth Social. The ballroom has faced legal issues, including an active lawsuit by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, but construction remains ongoing. Trump also has plans to erect a 250-foot arch between the Lincoln Memorial and Arlington National Cemetery, a structure that would dwarf most existing monuments in the area. Polling shows Americans are similarly opposed to that plan, with 52% against the project, including 41% who strongly oppose it. The poll found only 21% of people support the plan to build the towering arch. White House officials have defended the proposal, saying it would become one of the most iconic landmarks not only in Washington, D.C., but throughout the world. The arch, like the ballroom, is facing a legal battle as a group of local residents are attempting to block its construction, arguing its construction would cause irreversible damage to the area's protected historic landscape. Trump is also making his presence known in other parts of the city, including the proposed renovations of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, where he now serves as chairman of the board. He is now moving to overhaul the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool, resurfacing it as American flag blue coating. The move is part of a broader effort to upgrade the city's historical monument ahead of the semi-quincentennial celebrations. Moving on with articles on page A3. The first one reads, titled, Female Farmers Cut from Ag Board. Trump Administration Appoints Men Instead, by Carl Plume from Reuters. Chicago. The Trump administration rejected all four women farmers chosen by their peers to represent them in an industry group called the United Soybean Board earlier this year, a rare intervention by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that three of the women suspected was because of their gender. From the Pentagon to the U.S. Department of Education, the Trump administration has vowed to root out policies that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, from every layer of government. Normally, soybean farmers pick their representatives and the USDA signs off. This time, the USDA rejected at least five of the farmers selected for the United Soybean Board, including four women. It did not give any reasons, according to three of the women. Sarah Stelter, a Wisconsin farmer stripped of her role on the soy board, saw the decision as part of Trump's broader policy. It seems like a small thing, Stelter said, but in other ways it's a big deal because it's just another thing of where the current administration views women, I believe, and what their role should be. Reuters could not determine the reason for the USDA's rejection of the five candidates for the soy board. The USDA and the United Soybean Board did not respond for detailed questions from Reuters about the rejection, saying only that the Agriculture Secretary selects board members from candidates put forth by the state boards. The White House did not fulfill a public information request seeking any correspondence on the matter, citing a backlog of requests, and a spokesperson declined to comment, referring Reuters to the USDA. The administration has in the past year revoked equal pay initiatives enacted by the Biden administration and rolled back programs across the federal government that aim to correct past inequities impacting women and minority groups. The White House argues that such programs are illegal under laws against race and gender discrimination and work against merit-based advancement. Sean Harper, a University of Southern California professor whose research focuses on equity in business, education, and policymaking, said the intervention on the soybean board showed the administration's approach to diversity went beyond specific DEI programs and was affecting the federal approach to boards that work within particular industries. Groups like the United Soybean Board said are casualties of a blanket implementation of an anti-DEI policy and practice in the federal government. The USDA's action reduced the number of women on the 77-member board to 5, the lowest level in at least a decade. Women make up more than a third of U.S. farmers, but have historically held a smaller share of leadership roles in commodity groups. The Trump administration rejected 5 of the candidates vying for United Soybean Board director seats, some of whom the board had already appointed to an executive committee and roles overseeing the organization's $121 million budget and communications, current and former board directors said. Among 40 new and reappointed directors, none were women. Susan Watkins, a soybean farmer in Virginia whom the USDA rejected, said she was stunned by the decision. "We should be judged on our merit. It's very disheartening." I'll finish up the first half hour of the reading of the Pentagraph today with the short listings on Today in History by USA Today Network. Monday, May 4th, 1976. 1776, Rhode Island declared its independence from England, becoming the first North American colony to do so. 1865, Abraham Lincoln was buried in Springfield, Illinois. Mourners had paid their respects at his funeral train traveling through 180 cities and 7 states to reach his hometown. 1886, at a labor rally at Chicago's Haymarket Square, a bomb was thrown at police who were trying to break up the gathering. Police and protesters traded gunfire, and between the explosions and the gunfire, several people were killed and dozens injured. 1905, the second and successful attempt to build the Panama Canal and connect the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans officially began. 1961, the first Freedom Riders left Washington, D.C. aboard a Greyhound bus headed south. The 13 riders included a young John Lewis, who later served 33 years as a U.S. representative for Georgia. 1970, 28 National Guard members fired more than 60 rounds at anti-war protests on the campus of Kent State University, killing 4 people and wounding 9. 1990, the electric chair malfunctioned 3 times during the execution of Jesse Taffero in Florida, after which several states turned to lethal injection as a more humane method. We'll take a short break now and return with today's reading of the Pentagraph in a little bit. This was the first half hour of the Pentagraph on May 4th, 2026.